Join the National U Institute for our Foundations of Freedom Regional Seminars in California. We're stopping in Newport Beach on April 30th and then in San Jose on May 1st. These half-day conferences take place from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. and feature me, Rich Lowry, and Ramesh Panuru, along with Judge Janice Rogers Brown, John Yu of Berkeley Law, and Will Swaim of the California Policy Center. Register at nrinstitute.org. That's nrinstitute.org. Hope to see you there.
Bienvenidos. That's California for welcome to the March 20th edition of National Reviews, Radio Free California podcast. I'm Will Swaim, president of the California Policy Center. You can find my colleagues and me at californiapolicycenter.org. One of those colleagues is with me today. That's Lance Christensen, who's vice president of education policy and government affairs at California Policy Center. He's sitting in for my peripatetic co-host, David Bonson, who's out there on the book tour and otherwise doing business stuff. He gave me his itinerary, Lance, and it's numbing. He seems like he's much more up in the air than on the land.
So, sounds like a lot of fun. I'm glad to be with you.
I'm so glad to have you here. So we have a lot to get to today, but before we do that, I just want to point out I got to be with the wonderful Mike Rowe of, formerly of Dirty Jobs, and I think it was called Deadliest Catch. That's where he first kind of made his big impact on television. And that was a huge show among the younger Swaims back in the day. That's the one that I think it takes place, and you'll pardon my total ignorance of this because I didn't watch much of it, but Mike is the voiceover narrating the drama of being a lobsterman or a fisherman in general off the Alaskan coast. And then, of course, he comes back with Dirty Jobs, which was just like regular watching in our home. Everybody, all the way down to the youngest female distaff member of the family, everybody liked Dirty Jobs. I think the ladies partly liked it because Mike Rowe is so handsome. He's so handsome. But he's also just a wonderful host. I was on his podcast for my second time. He's on there with a guy named Chuck Klausmeier, who's down here in Southern California. Mike's up in the Bay Area. But we were all together in their Santa Monica studio talking about the malignant influence of California's politics on national politics, and particularly the change of the Department of Labor with regard to freelance rules, which was picked up in California as a kind of a virus and carried virus-like to D.C. by good old Julie Sue. Lance, I know you have some deep, and I'll say maybe dark thoughts about Julie, who's the acting Secretary of Labor under Biden, but before that was Labor Secretary for Gavin Newsom when Assembly Bill 5, that is the anti-freelance bill, was first rolled out. She'll be making little pop-up appearances throughout our run list today, but any initial thoughts on Julie Sue, the Department of Labor at the Biden administration, et cetera?
I think everything you have seen over the last several years from the Biden administration is a magnification of all the dysfunction of California. And so when people wonder, like, who cares about what happens in California and Sacramento, it's crazy. It's the left coast. It's going to fall in the ocean, right? We hear all those fun tropes. It seeps into everything we do. And I've given this speech before. This is not on Julie Sue specifically, but as goes Sacramento, goes the rest of the nation. And every major public policy debacle of the last 40 or 50 years can be traced back to Sacramento and its dysfunction. And so Julie Sue is just the next iteration of that. When she was in California, she blew up a lot of the COVID workers' comp stuff. I mean, the fact that we were literally giving billions of dollars to mafia, to people in prison, tons of fraud from other countries. There was no checks. And guess who gets to pay for that mistake? Not the state of California, which is really the taxpayers, but it's all the employers that were basically crushed underneath the thumb of Gavin Newsom, who had the longest shutdown of any state in the nation, and who almost uniformly and unilaterally took in and divested every small business of its right to exist. And so when we want to talk about these untoward corporations that gone and abused workers and their rights, as people like Lorraine Gonzalez and Julie Sue would say, I would remind them that it was their bosses and their best friends that destroyed the jobs for which these people could have any sort of independence and livelihood. So, they are not good people. But let's not pretend that, you know, the stuff in D.C. is not connected to what happens in California and Sacramento.
Yeah, I think it's interesting always to wonder if this is just in the air, you know, these kinds of nutty ideas, and California is correlated but not causally related to that. And I think there's an argument to be made for some things that appear all over the place almost simultaneously, probably, you know, in many cases. For example, what's a good example? You wrote about artificial intelligence and how this bill that would require in California, this new law that's being proposed, would require anyone who enters into an agreement to use their face, their image, their likeness in any kind of commercial context must have representing them either an attorney or a union. You know, this is clearly a giveaway to two of the Dems' favorite California coalitions, unions and trial attorneys. But that same bill popped up, I want to say, in New York and Illinois simultaneously. So this was clearly a kind of a national Democratic Party playbook. But, you know, in the case of AB 5, you know, I think this is really a model that was at the time unique to California. And I think a lot of what happens in D.C. is inspired by California. It's not just because, you know, there's some sort of national playbook. It's because they look at California as a place where these crazy ideas can really be kind of tested out. And in this instance, the whole goal of Assembly Bill 5 was to make it impossible, make it very, very difficult for people to work as freelancers in order to drive them into larger corporations. And let me just say it this way, corporations that are much more friendly to organized labor. In part because larger corporations can afford the extra cost of union labor. They can take that in stride without losing their business model. But it also, in doing this, Assembly Bill 5 benefits those corporations in another way. It wipes out the freelance competition they feel, the real energy of small business competition in the marketplace. It just rose dramatically, the market share of, say, trucking companies, for instance, which I've written something about. So,
there are literally thousands of jobs that you cannot have an employer for, literally right. Thousands. And so it makes sense to allow for people the independence to contract with others on a mutually beneficial agreement. Now, are we saying that all contractees, contractors are going to be honest and upright in all of their dealings? No, that's why you have courts to adjudicate these things. But what the other side wants to do, the left wants to get rid of all contracts between people. They mm-hmm. want to have the overarching influence of the state, Big Brother, influencing every decision out there. And frankly, it's terrifying, and it's unworkable. It won't work.
Agree. I guess before we move too deeply into other really top line items, I just want to point out that you and I are recording this on Wednesday, March the 20th. That's one day after St. Joseph's Day. And I would appeal to non-Catholics in the crowd here, including you, good old Lance, but you'll appreciate this because it's really a historical note. St. Joseph Day, March 19th, is recognized at least regionally as the day on which the Swallows returned to San Juan Capistrano, the mission down there, which was established in 1776. In my childhood, going to the old mission school, little red cardigan sweaters, salt and pepper cords, etc., we were told that this really truly was a miracle. And I got to say that, you know, as I get older, the revelation, you know, which I started to pick up in high school science courses, was that, you know, swallows make this just remarkable. They are teeny tiny birds that fly between a region in Argentina and this tiny region in the United States of America. And they do this annually. And we're talking thousands and thousands of miles and time zones. Not that birds are wearing tiny wristwatches, but they are making this mass migration to come here. And as a young kid going to the old mission school, we celebrated their arrival as a you know, kind of a purely wondrous natural world event that, you know, God quite clearly in St. Joseph had a hand in. We were taught that St. Joseph was a carpenter, and the swallows, who of course build their tiny nests under the eaves of buildings and freeway overpasses and bridges and that sort of thing, that they too are builders. But one of my first jobs, I'm just so embarrassed to say this publicly. It's going to have PETA all over me. But, you know, as Jackson Brown once said, don't confront me with my failures. I'm already well aware. He said it more lyrically than that. But I'm already familiar with this shortcoming. But I was paid as a little boy in the spring to go around to people's houses. Yeah, pay me like $2 a week to take a hose to the swallows' nests because, you know, there was this belief they carry disease, you know, with bird mites and that sort of thing, and that they were certainly discoloring the beautiful beige stucco of every home in the master planned community of Mission Viejo. And one day I remember hosing these down in a neighbor's yard and going over to inspect the muddy remnants of the nest. And there inside were some tiny, tiny birds. You know, their eyes still lidded and gasping for air. And, you know, before I could really do much of anything, I just watched them expire, you know, one at a time, you know, four or five of them. And I remember you know, going over and turning off the hose and going home and just sobbing in my room until my mom discovered me in my shame. And it was a little bit like Adam and Eve, right? I was trying to hide out. And I couldn't do it anymore after that. Just a terrible thing. Also, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just saying we had dinner the other night talking about our chickens and our rooster that's cantankerous and looking forward to Sunday dinner in coming weeks. And my daughters were just devastated. They had never connected that thought. So, yeah. Oh. Anyway, go ahead.
But see, chickens that feed us are different from swallows that annoy us. There's something in there. And you know, as a commie in that brief period of time, not too brief, I came to really focus in on the celebration. I don't know if many listeners know this, but at the Mission San Juan, they have the annual Swallows Day parade, and a kind of little festival at the old mission school where we would dress up in, you know, the costumes imagined, I suppose, of the seigneurial class of Mexicans, Spaniards before them, of Californios after. And we would do these, you know, conventional dances. And then we have little kids dress up in quote unquote Indian costumes. I think the fact that most of the nuns in our school were from Wisconsin had something to do with the fact that they sang songs about paddling canoes along massive rivers, of which there are very few in Southern California at all. And they wore leather and big headdresses, a kind of an amalgam of the Native American image, I guess. But, we would have this big event, and as a commie, I became, you know, really obsessed with the idea that this celebration only began in earnest in the 1930s and was sponsored by the equivalent back then of the Chamber of Commerce. And so I really hated this. You know, the Chamber of Commerce was using this sacred event to try to sell homes, till it occurred to me that you can't sell a tradition. You can't use a tradition to sell commercial development or real estate development, unless people have a kind of a natural hankering, an appetite for tradition, for place, for the sacred. It doesn't work. So in a sense, you know, as I've gotten older, I've really looked at that as, you know, not so much a takeover as a convenient acquisition that leverages the human desire for living in a place that is deeply rooted in tradition. I don't know if that makes any sense.
It does. And it's interesting. I've been reading a lot about just civilization and going back thousands of years. And I have more questions than I have answers now. But what I have found is that when a group of people, a society, gets together in a certain place and they really build something there, it is hard for future generations to truly understand what happened there. And it's hard after five or six generations to perpetuate that unless there is a strong and cohesive community. And when you lose that community, you lose a lot of other things. And I think it was Leo Tolstoy talked about this, the fifth and sixth generation. If you can make it past that, then you're pretty solid, either religion or community or group. If you can't make it past that, things pass away and die pretty quickly.
Yeah, there's what's the old saying about wealth? The first generation, what you know this one, right? The first generation creates it. What is it? The second generation? Somebody's going to correct me on this. Some several thousands of people, including Bonson. The second generation, I think, tries to manage it, and the third generation just wastes it.
Yeah.
And by then it's all gone. Yep. So, Hey, let's jump over then to some of the real heavy duty items here. And I want to start with a fantastic story in Red State by Jennifer Van Laar. Here's the headline. Pardon me. Here we go. Back to my notes. Yes, here it is. Her headline is "Find the Votes." And that's in quotes, by the way. "Find the Votes. Newsom is scrounging for only Democrat mail-in ballots to pass the signature tax increase." So what Jen is referring to here is Proposition 1, which as of our recording, there are still 200,000. There's about 7.5 million votes that have been counted already in California. But of course, we have this just expanded ballot counting process, which was designed to increase voter participation by allowing people to mail in ballots. And so the process now takes about a month. So here we are now, a couple of weeks past the March 5th election. And we still have about 200,000 votes uncounted, Lance. And yet, Proposition 1, and I'll let you describe it in more detail if you'd like, but the bottom line is Gavin Newsom, who has spent about $20 to $25 billion in 5 years to eliminate homelessness, has in fact overseen the spectacular growth of homelessness in California. Having spent all that money, you might think he'd want to stop digging. But instead, he's come back with Proposition 1, which would cost about another $6 to $7 billion immediately, at an interest and principal cost of somewhere in the neighborhood of $15 billion over 30 years, once it's paid back, to set up more treatment beds and, you know, some housing and that sort of thing. Weirdly, Newsom has spent about $17 million to get this thing passed against an opposition which was unfunded, which has declared zero spending in the No on One campaign. So again, Newsom has spent about $17 million, has raised and spent about $17 million, and the other side has spent about zero. And yet there are about, I think the yes versus no is about 17,000 right now. Does that sound about right, Lance? It's 20,000 or less.
Well, anyway. It was 21, just around 21,000 when I looked a few minutes before we started this podcast.
Okay. But yeah. So what Newsom has done now is to avoid all press contact. We can talk a little bit about that because there's been some fun tweets coming out of the Capitol Press Corps up in Sacramento. But Newsom is really dodging any kind of explanation for how he misjudged this campaign. He was so confident, so just knew his fame and his literal fortune here would help carry the day, but it hasn't. And so he's kind of hiding out. Also, he's got a massive budget crisis we'll come to in a moment. But I think what's really fascinating to me is that in Jen's story, she points out that Newsom has launched a massive, I'm quoting, has launched a massive statewide effort to find the votes he needs to ensure the passage of Prop 1 through his Campaign for Democracy PAC, Political Action Committee. So here's the story behind that. Newsom, you know, over the years has raised millions and millions and millions of dollars into a political action committee. If this happened on the right, of course, it would be called dark money. But when it happens on the left, it's just enlightened investment in the public's future, blah, blah, et cetera. But he's using this money now from this PAC to send Democratic activists into heavy Democratic areas to try to really pull a kind of Florida vote recount circa 2000 to really dig into ballots that from Democrat ballots that may have been rejected for reasons of, say, a missing signature or some other kind of technical violation. So he's only looking at the Democratic ballots in Democratic districts. Jen has a copy of the email that went out to Democratic activists, and you'll give me just a moment here, Lance, to read it. It says, "Governor Newsom needs you. Here's why. As you know, Proposition 1 is a once-in-a-generation reform to help people with serious mental illness and substance abuse problems get out of the shadows and out of encampments and into the housing and treatment facilities they need to get better. The votes are being counted, and it is close, like just a couple thousand votes close." And then in bold letters, it reads, "We need help reaching out to Democrats who have had their ballots rejected for things like forgetting to include a signature, and we need to get their votes counted." And then there's a couple of bullet points about how to do this, how to sign up, how to identify somebody in your district whose vote was not counted for one of these ballot irregularities. But what's remarkable is just, you know, how heavy-handed this is and how much it mirrors a fairly recent former president's attempt to gather just 11,000 votes in the state of Georgia, right? If Donald Trump had been more sophisticated in his approach and had unleashed PAC money to send Republicans out to go find rejected Republican ballots for Trump, he might have avoided the entire conflict. I doubt it, because the Democrats would still be all over it.
I mean, just consider who's working for whom, right? We have the loyal palace guard called the media, who will frame anything that they don't like as fascist and, you know, whatever, totalitarian, fill in the blank. So you and I have been called every name of the book. But when it's the left that can't seem to get a simple ballot initiative passed. Now, remember, Gavin Newsom cleared the ballot for this. There are several other initiatives that came from even the legislature. One to like get rid of gay marriage from the Constitution, Prop 8 from the Constitution. It wasn't a ban on gay marriage. I hate when people say this, and not you. I hate you, but affirmation of marriage, right? It's not a ban on polygamy or a ban on incest. It's just affirming marriage. So anyway, he pushed all of those to November, so he could clear out this Proposition 1 and $1,000 spent by the opposition. $1,000. That's spit in the bucket money. It's not even a rounding error. It's not even budget dust. It's nothing when he spent millions of dollars and cleared the slate. And we're down to a few thousand. At one point in time, it was 1,600 votes that was separating this. So it's not just the Democrats. Now the Republicans have finally figured out that they can go out and also get votes too. So they're asking anybody who wants to make sure their ballot was signed and cured that they can do it as well. But this sort of stuff shouldn't surprise us, this gamesmanship. But let's quit acting like elections are holy and sacred times anymore, because they're not. And in California, when you allow for, 37, 38 days to vote, when you mail a ballot to everybody, and in my last house, we bought a house. We lived on the same street for 15 years. We had had the house for over 2 years. I knew the previous owners. I didn't know the ones before that, but they had lived there for 30 years. The last election in 2020, November 2020, I had 5 ballots come to my house that were not mine. 5. I went, and 2 of the ones I knew, and I said, "Hey, you gotta count this out. You haven't lived here for years." The other 3, I have no idea. So I called Secretary of State. I'll call the county registrar's office, and I destroyed the ballots. I did what any good citizen would do. That was my house, and a house that had been owned by the same people for 30 years. I'm not satisfied that what we're doing in California is not messed up. And let's also take one other thing too. Christine, I can't remember her last name. She was running for the United States Senate. She was a news broadcaster down in Southern California. The Secretary of State screwed up her name and ballot designation on purpose and couldn't fix it. Now, she had no chance of winning this election or coming top 2, zero chance. But they were not willing to fix that at all. So we have a system in California that needs a lot of cleaning up, and having ballots for 38 days, and you've got a guy who can't even get what he spent millions of dollars on past, we have a massive problem here in California, and we need to figure it out.
Well, I think that's a nice segue. I'm going to shake up the run list here for you, Lance, so try to follow along. reverse, of course. Katie Porter says in a recent interview with Pod Save America, the Big Dem podcast, very progressive, she was there to sort of apologize for her use of the word rigged as her explanation for why she lost the U.S. Senate race to Adam Schiff and Steve Garvey. The election was rigged, she said, in the hours after she was, you know, a wild third place finisher. I mean, like way down. The election was rigged. She went on Pod Save America to make 2 points, she says. Number one, she wishes she had chosen a different word, because what happened with the controversy was it took away from 2 really important points. And Lance, her first point was, our California election officials do a terrific job. They should be the model for a lot of the country, in my opinion, she says. So again, she's there to say, like, look, I shouldn't have called it rigged. It's not really rigged. But and it did distract from the fact, she says, the California elections are just like kind of the gold standard for most of the nation. And yet here you and I are talking about the abuse in the electoral system, the, if not outright fraud, the just incompetence of sending multiple ballots to a single voter, that, you know, really kind of raises the skepticism level of a lot of people. You know, I have Democrats who love to tell me that anybody who is concerned about election integrity is just, you know, kind of waving a bloody rag, and there's nothing to see here. There's no evidence. This is a problem. And I like to ask them, how often do you leave your front door open when you leave on vacation? How often do you leave your car running with the keys in the ignition and the door open? How often do you let your child just wander down the street, your toddler? We take precautions not because bad things happen in such, you know, huge numbers that we are likely to become victims. We take these precautions. It's just a matter of course. So voter integrity is a problem, especially psychologically, I would argue, that we do this to protect ourselves against the eventuality of a massive corruption scheme. But anyway, she's here to say that this, I think, at very minimally, an incompetent election system, but more likely just, you know, really grotesque rigging. I think she's right that the system is rigged in some respects. I'm not, please hear me, I'm not saying the elections are stolen, but I am saying we have a political establishment that really does hold most of the cards. So let me also now apologize for using the rigged word. But
Will, do we need to apologize? And again, I friendly pushback here, but like language is supposed to be clear. And we don't have to say that elections were stolen. And I don't agree with that. I think you and I are both on the same page. But when we talk about rigged, yeah, I mean, everything's rigged a certain way. It's rigged just simply means that's the way it was put together, you know? And so we allow for other parties or groups of people to raise money and spend it on stuff. I think that campaign contribution limits are actually unconstitutional personally. We live in a system now where you can report all contributions within 24 hours without any problems. We actually have a Secretary of State in the state of California that refuses to update a system that's just completely terrible. So when we're trying to track all this money coming back and forth, they make it unduly and impossible. And you and I have talked about this before, tracking union money. It's rigged with union money. It's rigged with a lot of other interest. And so Katie Porter, she's trying to make the point in this podcast is saying, well, we have all these super PACs, crypto money, you know, people want to be regulated. Well, may or maybe not, or maybe she's just a terrible person. They don't like her. So yeah, like I don't apologize for the word rigged. I think Molly Hemingway did a great job outlining what that term means over 200 years of political history in the United States. But Katie Porter, yeah, if she had won, she wouldn't complain about it being rigged. Mm. Right? So back to your point, yes, it's all about who owns the terminology and who made the point.
Well, in her case, she says, I'm sorry I used rig because it really distracted from the fact that California's election system is, you know, again, gold standard. And second, she said, but though I shouldn't have used the word rigged, I should have pointed out the problem of money. And she has used in her explanations for rigged, she has tried to say, what she's really talking about is dark money. And of course, dark money is, in the eyes of a Democrat, any legal movement of cash between conservative entities to educate the public on a particular issue or candidate. She hates that. What she doesn't hate is the same process as it occurs, not just routinely, but is a feature of, a function of the Democratic money machine in California. Now, David Bahnsen upbraided me, and David's not here to defend himself, but you know, I'll raise this issue with him if he likes. But a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about, I think the phrase political establishment, and David said, well, there is no establishment, stop. And I understand what he's upset about. He's upset about the rise of that word on the right, among, you know, sort of pro-Trump or Trump-adjacent kinds of groups to talk about rhinos, you know, the Republican establishment and that sort of thing. I don't think David likes that use there. But I didn't make the argument in that case because I wanted to move on from whatever issue we're talking about, there is a political establishment. It's fair to acknowledge in California, for example, that we have a Democratic supermajority, that every statewide office is controlled despite your best efforts in a recent election, Lance, and thank you for your service in running for state superintendent of public instruction, that every statewide office is held by a Democrat, that those Democrats are funded almost entirely by unions, and especially only by government unions, who then, you know, once they have paid for your campaign and you get into office, those candidates who now have become public officials turn around and return the favor with legislation that gives those union leaders the things they want. People like Lorena Gonzalez, who gets AB 5. People like the teachers unions, who then get total control over a public agency called your local school district. So the curriculum that is taught, controlled by the teachers union. And if you violate that, we saw it in this most recent election, you're going to get crushed by dark money from the left. Our own Andrew Davenport, who works very closely with you, Lance, put together a piece. I'll put it in the show notes, showing how five rural counties in California, the central committees in five rural counties up in the north, primarily Mendocino and Humboldt and others, are responsible for the majority of union campaign cash. Now, it's not coming organically out of these sparsely populated rural counties like Humboldt or Mendocino. It's money that is moved from the California Teachers Association, for instance, and its various affiliates that is moved through these central committees where it can then be laundered and then show up back home in the districts of these school teachers unions as money that came from, you know, the Humboldt County Democratic Central Committee. And there's no fingerprints on it anymore unless you're Andrew Davenport or Lance Christensen or Will Swaim and you work with a think tank and you can spend the time tracking this cash down. So let me sum it up this way. As you once told me, if Democrats didn't have double standards, they might have no standards, whatever. And dark money is only money that is moved legally by conservative or Republican groups. When it occurs in the left, it's not to be spoken of. We sent Andrew's report to every major newspaper and specifically targeted the reporters who would report on these kinds of things, you know, political reporters and teacher people who report on teachers unions, that sort of thing. Zero bites, not a one, even after phone calls and follow-up emails pointing out that, wow, there is a dark money case to be made here, but it's on the left. Not a peep, Lance.
A lot of people. And let me add to this, too. What they've done is they've manipulated a completely legal system where the unions, if they're not coordinating with the party, can send unlimited contributions to the central committees of these counties. And they do. But what we found out is they actually are communicating yes. and coordinating because they admitted so through email.
Like, yeah, can you tell that story? Tell the story about what Andrew did and what Andrew found in this one instance, please.
Yeah, so Andrew does the research. He goes back through, and all of a sudden he's like, why is all this money, the Central Committee money, going back to state senator?
Was it Josh Newman?
Josh Newman.
Out of Orange County, L.A.
Out of Orange Beach. County from these places that are literally, like, talking about hundreds of miles away. Humboldt County and other ones. So what we did is we actually had Andrew go and ask them. He connected with them, and one of them was the sorry, I just pulled it open here. The Tehama County Democratic Central Committee Chair Kathy Cole. She says part of our program, overseen by the California State Senate Democratic Caucus, in which funds predominantly from labor unions are deposited into our DCC bank account. These funds are strictly for the caucus request that the Central Committee send specific amounts to targeted state Senate campaigns at strategic times and election cycles. She admitted as much. And then, when just to make sure, a few minutes later, she fall back and said, oh, you can't quote me on that. You can't say what I just said because I gave away the secret. And what we did is we tracked all of this money that's funneled and coordinated by the state Senate Democratic caucus. And the FPPC wants nothing to do with the story. We call them and asked.
That's the Fair Political Practices Commission.
Fair Political Practices Commission, which is in charge of all the rules, correct, of all these things. They want nothing to do with this. We've sent this report, as you've said, not just to all the newspapers, but other bloggers and reporters on this issue as well. Nobody's reporting on it. It's on our website. Anybody who's listening to this can go and read it. But yet, at the same time, they want to. Katie Porter wants to whine about rigged elections. This is rigged. This is completely rigged by a political establishment that doesn't even have to really coordinate very hard because the unions work hat in hand with the Democratic Party in California. And that's not just millions of dollars. In this race, it was particularly targeted towards who? The chair of the Education Committee in the Senate, Josh Newman, who at this very moment that you and I are talking, is defending his bill in committee, SB 907, to dismantle elections in Orange County Board of Education, specifically only that area, with David Minn, his accomplice, to dismantle that so they can get back control over a 5-0 majority, which has been worked hard by the people who represent that area. So you want to talk about rigged and establishment? Just look at SB 907. Josh Newman of the Education Committee and of the Democratic Party in Orange County receiving millions of dollars from up north, which, by the way, less than 1,000 came from San Bernardino, LA, and Orange County, for which the county seat represents. Less than $1,000. And not any money went from those counties to the legislators that actually represent them. Okay. So, yes, 100% California elections are rigged with money that's coming from the Democratic or from the unions of the Democratic Party. So I said it.
Yep. So here's Katie Porter on Pod Save America. What got lost in all of that is her use of the word the election was rigged. That's why she lost to Schiff and Steve Garvey in the Senate run, is that, quote, big money does influence our elections. She goes on to say, outcomes are manipulated and distorted when you have people coming in and spending millions and millions of dollars the last minute, and that money is not disclosed until after the election, so people don't know about it. Wow, Katie. I would love to see that kind of intellectual power focused, dilated on the Democrats. And this is, you know, I have loads of friends still who are Democrats. I have Democrats in my family. This is not an anti-Democrat screed. It is a Democrat partisan politics, political machine screed that I'm engaged in here. Just the double standard is outrageous to me.
Russian denier, Katie Porter, yes.
There, boom. Remind me, that's the headline for the episode. We'll have several other possibilities, other candidates for title here. I want to point out another really fascinating story about how the system works. I wrote a piece in National Review that appeared Monday on the state budget, and I was pointing out that Gavin Newsom was, you know, 2 years ago, Gavin Newsom acts like he's just broken for the first time the 4-minute mile, which of course was broken in the late 1950s. But he acts like he's just created this amazing historic event because he's got $100 billion surplus in the California budget. We pointed out at the time there was no budget surplus because state and local entities in California owe something like $1.6 trillion in debt. $1.6 trillion versus $100,000 is not a budget surplus, Governor Newsom. Nevertheless, he was crowing about his big victory, $100 billion surplus. He went out and, you know, talked about how much money. It was like watching Oprah Winfrey. There's money under everybody's seat in the audience. And now here we are. He's staring down a $78 billion deficit. And he's just kind of playing hijinks. I'll just go over this, Lance. We don't have to spend a whole lot of time talking about the budget because David and I have talked about it a little bit before. But I do want to just remind people that the first thing he did was to ignore the actual $78 billion number. He just like waved a wand and declared that it was half that, that his own estimate was that we only owed half that, not $73 billion, about $38 billion, so a little more than half. And he vilified any reporter who reported the higher number. Then he tapped the state's rainy day fund for half of that amount. So we go from $38 billion, he cut $13 billion out immediately by tapping the rainy day fund, which is supposed to only be used in a recession. That's what it says in the law. This is not a recession, although we could argue that California is undergoing its own kind of Newsom recession. But he didn't try to argue that. He just, nobody stopped him. He just went in and raided the rainy day fund for $13 billion. And then third, as Dan Walters observed, Newsom dug deep into the bag of tools the state has historically used to paper over deficits. In one instance that I found reported, Newsom has pushed the June payroll of public employees from June to July 1st. We're on a fiscal, not calendar year in California's budgeting. So he just said, okay, we're going to pay government employees in June, what we owe them in June, but we're going to account for it in July. And as I wrote, you know, by the time this, you know, this will produce some additional drag on next year's numbers, which are supposed to be equally bleak. I said, but that's some other Gavin Newsom's problem, right? That's Gavin Newsom holding himself hostage to fortune, but he'll deal with that problem when he gets to it, I guess. So another thing that I pointed out was that Newsom had failed to file, as federally and constitutionally required in California, had failed to file the state's 2022 financials. You're supposed to, every state is supposed to report its, you know, financial documents. And Lance, I used to know these things were called CAFRs, but that became associated with a, I think, almost unknown,
a derogatory term in Africa. Yeah,
in South Africa, right? I don't think most people were paying attention to that, but anyway, the annual financials, with which you're very familiar because you used to work for John Morlock, who now also works for us, these financials were supposed to have been published over a year ago, or about a year ago. And they weren't. And we kept up the drumbeat here at CPC, like, where are the documents? When are you going to show us the documents? It's the documents we'd really like to see. The documents finally came out after the election, after March 5th, and specifically after this governor asked voters to contemplate a nearly $7 billion increase in the general debt in California. So, you know, we have some speculation that he was trying to play hide the ball here. By releasing this, not just late, not just after the election, but at 4 p.m. on Friday. Now, as a journalist, I know, and as a, I think, an insider, you know, if you want to bury news, you release it on Friday afternoon when all the reporters are going home and nobody's reading the newspaper because we're all getting ready for the weekend. So the 2022 financials finally came out. They're a mess. California's financial picture is worse than we thought. Our unrestricted net deficit, that is when you take liabilities, you subtract liabilities from income or from cash on hand. Now, have I got that right, Lance? I just want to make sure I got the formula correct. The unrestricted net should be you take all liabilities, subtract those from all of your assets. That includes cash on hand and stuff you own, you know, buildings and parks, et cetera, et cetera. Our unrestricted net deficit is now $222 billion. It went up dramatically over the last couple of years. It is in the aggregate the largest unrestricted net deficit in the country. We are number 7, however, per capita. So even per capita, when you take California's massive population, you would expect that we might have the largest aggregate numbers. But we're number 7 among the worst. So if you take the worst of all states in terms of their fiscal health, California dropped 2 spots from the last time, the 2021 financials, to be worst in the nation. Of the 50 states, just 2 other states saw their balance sheets worsen. That's Alaska and South Carolina. And John Morlock, the aforementioned state senator you used to work for as chief of staff up in the state Senate, who now works for us as a finance analyst, told me, one wonders what the outcome of Prop 1 would have been if the report had been released on time 15 months ago or even 2 weeks before March 5th. Surely many voters might have opposed increasing this record high unrestricted net deficit. Lance, before I move on, any other thoughts here?
Do you mean that the governor rigged the election too with this? Like, at some level, we should, this, most of the stuff, AI is not the place where most of these statements can be done literally in a matter of seconds. You plug in the numbers and you get the outcome, have a human go through and make sure it's clean and all that kind of stuff. But there's no reason we should have these reports coming out 15 months late. 15 months late. That just shows how bad it is. And in California, we have this thing called, FISCAL, which is supposed to be the supreme accounting. We've spent over $1 billion on it. I think now the number continues to grow and it still doesn't produce the reports that was purported to produce years ago. I think it's about time to get my teenage son to get his ChatGPT and his iPhone together and just take over the state's IT system. I mean, this is so ridiculous where we are now in California.
The other interesting note that John and our friend Mark Jaffe, formerly of Cal Policy Center, formerly of Reason, now at Cato, just, you know, one of the best minds on public finance in California, they identified this footnote in the state's document, this document that was released just a few days ago at 4 p.m. on a Friday. I'll read, well, I'm tempted to read the entire footnote, but I'll summarize it this way. The footnote in the document, in this financial, says it's really hard for us to figure out precisely what the financials should look like, in part because we still have this obligation to repay the federal government the money it loaned our unemployment department, our employment development division, it's called EDD, during COVID. The money that you referred to just a moment ago as Julie Sue's absolute loss to international crime gangs and other fraudsters. We lost somewhere in the neighborhood of $30 billion. So the financial department, the auditor, in putting together these financials said, the EDD had inadequate internal controls over its financial reporting for federally funded unemployment insurance benefits, including not properly estimating the total population of ineligible payments. As a result, her department, the auditor's department, the EDD was unable to provide complete and accurate information for certain accounts within the federally funded portion of that program. So Julie Sue screws up the EDD in California, squanders loses $30 billion to international crime gangs, prisoners, ineligible recipients all over the world, and for her sins is promoted to become acting head of the secretary, the Labor Department under the Biden administration, where she continues the grift. So there's just loads of fascinating intel in this document. And I think the other thing is that it points out that we had understated, California had its debts in the prior year, that is in 2021. So we've been going now for a couple of years with this belief that the 2021s, which were the most recent financials, were accurate. They're not. And now the 22, trying to correct for it, says we really can't come up with an accurate number because Governor Newsom and his Secretary of Labor, Julie Sue, screwed up so badly.
So what we're going to do is we're going to watch, as you just described, a lot of gamesmanship with these numbers over the next several months, shifting costs from one fiscal year to the next and whatever else is happening. We're going into a massive, massive meltdown with our state financials, and our cities and counties are struggling as well as our school districts. So it's no wonder the governor delayed his State of the State address after all of this massive confusion. Yeah,
didn't even point that out. Duty. That was supposed to be Monday, I believe, right? His State of the State. But because Proposition 1's hanging in the balance, because the budget deficit is so extraordinary right now, because these financials just leaked, it is very hard to imagine the governor coming out. No, it's not hard to imagine. I was going to say it's hard to imagine the governor coming out and making a case that the State of the State is strong, because that's exactly what he would do. It's exactly what he did do when he debated on Governor Ron DeSantis on the Hannity, with Sean Hannity on Fox. You and I talked before that debate, and we agreed, look, the facts are in. Florida, Ron DeSantis wins before the Klieg lights turn on and the cameras start rolling. The question now is just theatrical. Who will perform better? And Newsom has this charisma for folks on the left. They just absolutely adore this guy. And, reading about the people's responses to the debate was just like asking, are you conservative or progressive? That would determine entirely your perspective on his performance there. But I do think the numbers are getting more and more bleak. And my own sense, Lance, is that Gavin Newsom is probably hoping like hell that Joe Biden excuses himself from this run, that Kamala Harris somehow opts out, and that he can just run to Washington and hide out, maybe as VP even under Kamala. But I think he just wants desperately to get out of town before the roof caves in over at the governor's mansion.
Yeah, I mean, he's been seen a few times recently at the state legislature and the Capitol trying to meet with legislative leaders. They're in full panic mode. Even, I presume, Prop 1's going to pass. It's not going to be by a big margin. It's going to be tiny. But that is not a vote of confidence going into this next year, especially when now you're going to have to cut a whole bunch of other programs to go and pay for the debt service on this massive new bond that you have for years down the road.
You know, Lance, we got a lot on this run list, and I have I should have kept a leash on my own mouth here. But I want to get to a story that you have a lot of knowledge of. You wrote a piece about it. We are in March here in 2024. So we're 4 years celebrating, quote unquote, the 4 year anniversary of the COVID lockdowns in California. And you wrote a terrific piece in the Orange County Register, the LA Daily News. That's the Southern California News Group. It's about 11 papers down here in SoCal. The headline is, "The harmful consequences of COVID-era school closures will be with us for years to come." And I really want to go over that, but I want you to keep in mind this other news that has come out in kind of dribs and drabs, that the California legislature, and specifically Assemblymember Anthony Rendon, who was the former speaker, right, of the assembly, Rendon was, he has created a new committee, or commission rather, that will study happiness in California, how government can make us happier. And I just juxtapose those two things almost without comment. On one hand, pandemic lockdowns that, as you point out in your article, shut down our schools. And you say the ill effects of that, the malignant effects of the school closures specifically, in addition to the business closures and everything else that happened during COVID, that's what the government actually did to create unhappiness and despair. And then with no sense of irony, we've got Rendon now here running a committee in the legislature talking about how creating happiness should be the priority of government. I'm not averse to the idea that government can create the conditions for happiness by getting the hell out of our ways most of the time and allowing us to pursue that sense of moral virtue on our own independently of the government. But I know that's not what Rendon has in mind, because it has been revealed in various reports. So, Lance, why don't you start with the fourth anniversary of the COVID lockdowns and their ill effects on education. You are VP of Education Policy here at California Policy Center. As I said a moment ago, you ran for Superintendent of Public Instruction, a statewide office. You know these things. So what happened, and what are we seeing as a result of the lockdowns? And then compare that to Anthony Rendon's new mission, make government responsible for making us happy.
Yeah, I don't need to relitigate the whole pandemic we all lived through. It was crazy. But what I remember as a father of five kids is that the schools were effectively shut down for them. And I had a daughter who had an IEP and was going through speech therapy, and you can't do that over Zoom or with a mask on. A very close friend, and I'm going to keep it ambiguous because of the circumstance, but found their oldest son bleeding with vomit all over him at 2 a.m. as he saw his baseball career go down the drain. Then I had my son, who's a junior in high school at the time, that the school couldn't figure out all of the different pandemic, you know, things to get these kids to take the PSAT, which a lot of people are like, well, who cares? It's just the PSAT. Well, if you're trying to be a National Merit Scholar, that's how you get it, is through the PSAT. Not to say that my son would have gotten it, but I think he was a good candidate. He graduated top of his class. He ate all AP classes and did really well. But guess what? Wasn't even an option, because the principal, who is a good man, just couldn't navigate the insanity that Gavin Newsom had put upon us. And so what we learned there is, our kids learned especially, is that adults, when faced with hard decisions, shut down and basically didn't defend them. And that's why I fought so hard, and maybe why I became a little adamant that the state government's schools are not a refuge of academics or of scholarship, that they are actually robbing our kids of so much more. And what most parents experienced during this thing is the veil was pulled back, because now they could see literally into the classroom. And they could listen to the teachers say what they were saying when it wasn't parent-teacher conference. And they could see how other kids were reacting and responding. I knew a kid that basically put a Zoom on all day long and went and started his own business. He made a lot of money and didn't go to class for one day. And let's just say his grades weren't so bad. He was capable and competent, but for about a year, I don't think he would just single day of class. So what do we do with these kids now, when two-thirds of our kids are not proficient in English and math, when we want to trade an economy that will provide for them in the future? We've talked about this in the past, but you can't go to most stores or fast food restaurants and deal with somebody who's competent. So what do? We replace them with kiosks. Well, there's only so many kiosks that you can replace in a society. And what we did is we've told these kids they just don't really matter, and that we're not going to fight for them very hard. And in the end, these kids are going to I think it's not going to turn out well for the older generations. And I'm sad for that, for the mistrust. And I also believe, too, that parents need to realize that just sending your kid blindly to a government school is not always the best path. And you should step back and really evaluate your situation. I'm saying that as a father of five kids who all of them have gone through the public school system, but have done so intentionally. And when we wanted school choice, we literally picked up and moved 45 miles away to a different place. Not everybody can do that. But we saw what was happening in our previous school district. And when I look back there, it's a mess. It's a complete mess. But I'm now in a school district where we actually have teachers and administrators who care and who are teaching things, and respect and discipline is the order of the day. That is not what happened for 3 years in California for most school districts.
Yeah, I think what's best about your story is that it really recaptures my sense of the betrayal on the part of our generation. I'm speaking here roughly because I'm far older than you, but you know, people older than me, younger than me, but you know, roughly speaking, the parents, you know, parents and grandparents who should have known better, went along with the idea that shutting down everything was critical to all public health. And as we documented in this podcast, almost every week throughout the pandemic and the lockdown, this was a disease which, as one expert told me, you know, thank God, went after the elderly rather than the young. And as he said, that's not great, but it beats the alternative. Right. This was not a disease that was fundamentally targeting, you know, kids under five or kids under 18 or even people under 35. It was going after people with really powerful, malignant comorbidities, underlying comorbidities, but especially the elderly. And so for the sake of those people, arguably, we sacrificed the kids. And that betrayal is not lost on kids. They know. I ought to have pulled, but did not, a story that showed up in the press in the last couple of days, which shows that, for, you know, again, levels of self-reported happiness in the U.S., and especially in California, interestingly, are way down. But with this stipulation or this caveat, the people who are happiest in the U.S., 60 and over, 60 and over. This represents a real pessimism among young people in America. And this COVID experience cannot have helped them at all. One of the other things, Lance, that I want to finish with here is just a recent development out in Chino Valley. You were deeply involved in the effort to spread parent notification around the state. And I'll just give a quick summary here, but Bill Asaley, assembly member, first term assembly member from Riverside County, drafted Assembly Bill 1314, which required school districts to notify parents if their kid wanted to make a change to his or her gender or name or other kinds of public behavior. They were supposed to, the schools were supposed to let the parents know, hey, you know, John wants to be called, I don't know, Gene. Or, you know, Sam wants to be called Samantha and also wants access to the girls' swim team or something like that. So a change in their public document. And that was important at the time because, as you pointed out very early on, the state policy was actually to lie to parents. Now, I keep reading activists on the progressive left saying that's not true. There was never any such policy. You were able to find it right in state law. But one of the interesting things that was also simultaneously happening was that, you know, all kinds of crazy books were being revealed to be used in the curriculum. So parents were sitting at home during the lockdown, watching these, you know, some of these teachers, not all, I would argue a sizable minority, were going along with the kind of, I'm just going to call it the progressive ideology around sex, especially. And some of these parents got very, very upset. They ran for school board. They won. And once there, they picked up Bill Asaley's Assembly Bill 1314 because it was blocked in the state legislature. They picked it up at the local level. And what do we have now, Lance? 11 school districts that have picked this thing up, I think?
Yeah, it's between 11 and 15. There's various iterations, but yes, well over a dozen.
Okay. So what's interesting is here's the headline from EdSource. Chino Valley, which was one of the school districts, I think the first school district to pick up parent notification. Chino Valley revamps its parent notification policy. LGBTQ plus allies fear legal escalation. The headline itself is just weird. So maybe you can back up, give us the context, and then tell us what's going on down there.
Yeah. So again, without going through all the nuances of this, when we did the parental notification district by district, the idea was to do within 72 hours, you know, the administration or teachers would notify a parent if something was changing, if the kid was going to locker rooms, if the kid was, you know, changing clothes, wanting to be called by a different name or pronouns. And what the court said in Chino, and the attorney general came after them very, very hard, was that, well, you can't really discriminate against kids that are transgender. And we were saying, listen, this is really not about the transgender thing specifically. Yes, that's a big piece of this. But this can apply to any kid who's going through a mental health crisis, suicidality, I mean, other anxiety problems that would elicit these kinds of responses. And just general confusion as a teenager, right? So as a parent, your kid may not be transgender, but they just may be confused about life and other things and need some sort of interaction. So what the court did is they came back, and it was a weird series of events with this this judge down in San Bernardino County. And eventually he said, okay, we'll allow for part of this policy to stand, which would require for the administration of the school to contact parents if their official or unofficial documents have been changed. And actually, that's a huge win. Huge win. So what Chino Valley did is they said, okay, we'll just take what the judge said. That's the policy now. And it is essentially the same exact policy. It's refined, but it's the same thing we were trying to accomplish before. So guess what? Now the court has said that's right there. In Temecula, they said the same thing there. Then you have a federal court that said the same thing in Escondido. And then you have the other school district that had awarded the money to the mother of the child that was secretly transitioned up here north in Spreckles. So you have those four cases. It's 4-0 right now, Will. We're winning. And what most parents need to understand is that we're actually towing what the law says, that we're not allowed to lie to parents. And getting back to your comment earlier, it's actually not state law that they don't lie to parents. It's actually the opposite. But what happened was Tony Thurman, the superintendent of public instruction, in his frequently asked questions, so kind of like these aren't the policies, but these are recommendations on how you go forward, is to create a false file for these kids that may be experiencing these struggles in life and not let the parents know that that exists. Lied to them when they asked explicitly about this, continue to lie to them and make sure everybody else at the school lies to them. And so, as I said, the Rockland School District, when they adopted a similar policy back this last fall, I said, really, trust is what we're trying to seek for. Once the parents don't feel like they can trust the teachers or the administration, you lose all fidelity to the system of public education. And this gets back, actually, and ties into our other institutions like elections and the media. We've lost faith that they can do these things, but we have hope because we are winning. So I need parents and activists and advocates that are listening to this to understand there is a path forward. You have to stand and be counted, and you have to stop being afraid of being called names, fill in whatever blanks you can, because we are winning, but it's a slow grudge, and it requires a day-by-day march. And that's why you and I are here. We're here at California Policy Center to move and advance these ideals, because we believe that California can be the wonder of the world again. And it won't take much more than a few courageous parents and other public officials to stand up.
Yeah, I'll just add that before we close out here, Lance, that one of those courageous officials, I mean, there are countless courageous officials, you know, the folks out in Temecula and Chino and elsewhere, Orange County, Orange Unified, up and down the state, we saw these parents and these officials really stand up during COVID and in the years since. One of those is Will O'Neill. I'll put his op-ed in the show notes. Will is a friend, full disclosure, longtime friend, and the mayor of Newport Beach. And he just wrote a brilliant piece on how the pandemic really revealed the character of progressives who felt that they knew what was best for everybody, no matter your situation in life, whether you were older with underlying comorbidities or young and virile and healthy, you know, the state was going to tell you how to live your life. And so we had Gavin Newsom shutting down Orange County beaches just as a matter of kind of political retribution. And then admitting later that, you know, I might have overreacted, but, you know, hindsight is 20/20, Newsom said. So I'll just put Will's piece in there. I think that the power in California at this point, or the, let's say the leverage, is at the local level. And that doesn't mean that it's easy or unencumbered. It just means that at the state level, as we said earlier, you know, all statewide offices occupied by progressives, the entire legislature owned and operated by the government unions who those legislators are supposed to oversee. Talk about tails wagging dogs. So the local level is a place where the public can still make its voice heard, can still have an impact. But even there, you know, as we saw in the Orange Unified School District, where we had a really strong conservative majority. When I say conservative, I mean constitutional. I'm not talking about right-wing crank. I'm talking constitutional conservatives who are very, very sensible people who pushed back on the COVID lockdown, who really resisted the kind of progressive tide of indoctrination in their schools. They were targeted by the California Teachers Association very famously, and the CTA won. They won in Orange Unified in a recall of two of those conservative
board members. They won by lying. They won by lying, and this is the problem. A lot of people who have responded afterwards were totally confused by what they were voting for. And Madison Minor, God bless that woman. She visited every single school within the first year of being elected, and this is how she gets punished. No other board member has actually done that same thing and gone with sort of passion to be there for these kids, to get them back in school and whatever. And what the Orange Unified Education Association has done is they said, this is the template for going and getting everybody else out. Now, Who are they going after now? Sonia Shah down in Chino. So if you care, and also Joe Komorowski down in Temecula, if you care about your school districts, don't buy into this garbage about recalling parent advocates who really care about oversight, about transparency and accountability. We can win and be back, but people need to understand what the stakes are, and it happens at the local district.
Well, that's all the time we have today, Lance. Thanks for joining me in David's absence. He tells me he will be back next week, but if he's not, I'll ask Lance to climb back into the co-host chair there. So on behalf of my friend and guest, Lance Christensen, we give thanks as ever to session producers Lucas Klaus, Brian Tong, and Glenn Hall, and to National Review podcast producer Sarah Schutte. Thanks also to Metalachi, that's the LA-based mariachi and metal band. They supply our intro and outro music. La revolución continúa en la semana próxima.